Okay, so you're ready to dive into some serious legal waters today.
That's right. We're going deep.
We're talking securities law, procedure, lawyer ethics, the whole shebang.
All wrapped up in one fascinating case.
Exactly. Securities Investor Protection Corp v. Vigman.
Now, that name might sound a little dry.
Maybe even a bit intimidating.
But trust me, the story behind it is anything but boring.
This case goes back to a massive stock manipulation scheme back in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, the kind of stuff that takes down whole broker-dealers.
And that's exactly what happened at FSSC and CBAG, both went under.
Leaving investors high and dry.
And that's where SIPC comes in. They had to shell out a whopping $13 million to cover those investor losses.
That's right. And that's what really gets the legal wheels turning.
SIPC, understandably, wanted to get that money back.
So they launched a massive lawsuit.
Against, wait for it, over 75 defendants.
Alleging securities fraud, RICO violations, the works.
Now, for those who might not know, SIPC, that's the Securities Investor Protection Corporation.
They're kind of like the FDIC, but for the investment world.
Think of them as insurance for your brokerage accounts.
Up to a certain limit, of course.
Right. So when a brokerage firm goes belly up, SIPC steps in to protect investors.
Make sure they don't lose everything.
So they made this huge payout, tried to go after the bad guys. Makes sense, right?
Seems logical, right? You'd think it would be open and shut.
But it wasn't. Not even close. They ran into a wall of legal obstacles.
Yeah, the case really highlights how tricky things can get, even when it seems like there's clear wrongdoing.
Exactly. And that's what we're going to explore today.
We're going to unpack those legal roadblocks, and trust me, there are some fascinating twists and turns.
First up, let's talk about those securities fraud claims.
Right. SIPC went after the defendants using Rule 10b-5.
Which, for our listeners who are still learning the ropes, is a big deal in securities law.
It's one of the main tools to combat fraud in the securities market.
But here's the thing. Their claims were ultimately shot down.
Yeah, and this is where we get into the nitty-gritty of legal procedure,
It all comes down to a concept called standing.
which basically means, do you have the right to sue in the first place?
And under Rule 10b-5, the courts have been very clear.
To have standing, you have to be a direct buyer or seller of the security that was manipulated.
This all goes back to a landmark Supreme Court case, Blue Chip Stamps v. Manor Drug Stores, back in 1975.
That case really cemented this whole purchaser-seller requirement.
Right, so you can't just be someone who is indirectly affected by the fraud.
You got to have skin in the game, so to speak. You need to have actually bought or sold the specific stock that was manipulated.
Now, in this case, SIPC, they weren't directly trading those stocks.
Right. They were coming in after the fact as what's called a sub rogi.
Basically, stepping into the shoes of the investors who got burned when those brokerage firms collapsed.
So they're trying to assert the rights of their customers.
Which seems reasonable, right? But the court said, not so fast.
Because even those customers, in this particular situation, didn't quite fit the definition of direct purchasers or sellers.
The courts wanted to see a more direct link.
A clear transactional nexus between the alleged manipulation and the customer's specific act of buying or selling.
Simply having an account with a brokerage firm that got caught up in the mess wasn't enough.
It's almost like the court was saying, look, we understand you got hurt, but you weren't directly involved in the specific transactions that were manipulated.
And because SIPC's right to sue was derived from their customers' rights, well, their claims under Rule 10b-5 hit a dead end.
So even though SIPC was out millions because of this alleged fraud, their claim was essentially blocked by this very specific rule of standing.
It really highlights how the law can sometimes draw very fine lines, even when it might feel a bit unfair in the grand scheme of things.
That's the law for you. It's all about meeting those very specific requirements.
Okay, so that's the securities fraud part of the story. But SIPC also tried another avenue.
They went after the defendants under RICO.
The Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act.
Yeah, this is the law that was originally designed to take down organized crime.
But it's been used in all sorts of cases involving financial fraud and other complex
And
schemes.
to win under RICO, you have to prove a few things.
One of the big ones is causation.
Not just any causation, but proximate cause.
And that's where things got tricky for SIPC.
Proximate cause basically means that the defendant's actions were a direct cause of the plaintiff's injury.
Not just that one thing led to another in some roundabout way, but a very clear, direct link.
Now, this whole idea of proximate cause in RICO cases was actually clarified later on by the Supreme Court in another case involving SIPC, Holmes v. SIPC.
And that case really emphasized the need for that direct connection.
So in Vigman, the court took a close look at the chain of events.
And they concluded that SIPC's losses, the money they had to pay out to investors, were too far removed from the defendant's actions.
In the court's view, the most direct victims were the investors who bought and sold those manipulated stocks.
The market itself was also harmed.
SIPC's losses were a secondary consequence.
It's like they were a victim of a victim.
So even though the fraud ultimately led to SIPC having to shell out millions, the causal chain was deemed too indirect for a successful RICO claim.
It's almost like the court was saying, look, we get it. You had to clean up this mess, but you weren't the primary target of the scheme.
So another key takeaway for our listeners, especially those who are thinking about RICO litigation, you've got to be able to draw that straight line from the defendant's bad acts to your client's specific injury.
No fuzzy connections, no detours. It has to be clear and direct.
Exactly.
Now, this case also has a fascinating ethical dimension that we need to discuss.
Oh, yeah. This is where it gets really interesting.
The defendants actually tried to get SIPC's own lawyers disqualified from the case.
And it all had to do with their prior experience working for the government.
Specifically for the SEC.
Two of SIPC's lawyers, Boltz and Hartman, had actually worked for the SEC earlier in their careers.
And here's the kicker. They had been involved in a previous SEC case against some of these same defendants.
Back in 1973.
Talk about a potential conflict of interest.
Right. Former government prosecutors now suing the same folks on behalf of a private entity.
Not a good look.
Not at all. And there's a specific ethical rule that addresses this.
Lay it on us.
It's ABA Model Rule 1.1A. Or some variation of it, depending on the jurisdiction.
And what does that rule say in a nutshell?
It essentially prohibits lawyers who used to work for the government from representing private clients in matters that are substantially related to cases they worked on while in government service.
Unless, of course, the government agency gives its consent. Makes sense. You don't want people exploiting their inside knowledge or government connections for private gain.
Exactly. It's all about maintaining public trust in the legal system.
So did the SEC give their blessing in this case?
Nope. Not a chance.
The court actually instructed SIPC to seek that consent.
But the SEC said, no way.
And that was a big factor in the court's decision to disqualify those lawyers.
Yeah, the court took those ethical rules very seriously.
Now let's dig a bit deeper into that substantially related test. What exactly does it take to trigger that rule?
Well, it's more than just having some general knowledge about a particular area of law.
Or maybe working in the same agency where a case was handled.
Right. It requires a more direct and significant involvement in the previous government matter.
So in this case, the court looked at the specific roles that Boltz and Hartman had played in that 1973 SEC case.
For Boltz, it came down to the fact that he had actually signed the SEC's complaint in that earlier case.
Which, legally speaking, is a big deal.
Huge deal. By signing that complaint, he was taking personal responsibility for the allegations being made.
Even if he couldn't remember every single detail from a case that happened decades ago?
Absolutely. The court said that the act of signing itself was enough to demonstrate substantial participation.
Interesting. What about Hartman?
Well, Hartman had served as the trial counsel for the SEC in that 73 case.
Meaning he was basically in charge of the day-to-day litigation.
Exactly. And the court decided that this supervisory role also met the threshold for personal and substantial participation.
So even though their memories might have been a bit fuzzy, their past involvement in that related case against some of the same defendants raised too many red flags.
It created that appearance of impropriety that the ethical rules are designed to prevent.
It really shows how seriously the legal system takes these rules about conflicts of interest, especially when former government lawyers are involved.
It's all about protecting the integrity of the process.
Now, before we wrap up, there's one more interesting aspect of this case that I want to touch on.
Right. SIPC also tried to make a case based on this idea of stock parking.
Sounds intriguing. What's that all about?
Stock parking is a way of hiding the true ownership of stocks.
Kind of like a shill game for securities.
Exactly. And SIPC argued that the defendants were using this tactic to make the brokerage firms look more financially stable than they really were.
Which would have contributed to their eventual collapse.
That was their argument.
Sounds like it could have been a strong point.
Potentially. But there was a major problem with how they handled it.
What happened?
They waited way too long to bring it up.
Ah, so we're back to the importance of legal procedure.
Precisely. In any legal case, you have to present your arguments and evidence in a timely manner.
You can't just spring new theories on the court at the last minute.
Right. And that's where the concept of waiver comes in.
Meaning you lose the right to make that argument if you don't raise it at the appropriate time.
Exactly. So even though this stock parking theory might have had some merit, the fact that SIPC waited so long to raise it meant that the court basically refused to consider it.
Another tough lesson for our listeners. Procedural rules matter.
They can make or break your case.
So let's bring it all together. What are the big takeaways from SIPC v. Vigman?
Well, first and foremost, standing is crucial, especially in securities fraud cases. You have to be a direct participant in the transaction that was manipulated to have the right to sue under Rule 10b-5. SIPC wasn't, and their claims were dismissed.
It's all about direct versus indirect harm.
Exactly. Second, when it comes to IRPO, that direct link between the defendant's actions and the plaintiff's injury is absolutely essential.
Proximate cause is key.
Absolutely. And in Vigman, the court found that SIPC's losses were too remote to satisfy that requirement.
And don't forget those ethics rules.
Right, especially for lawyers who used to work for the government.
Those rules are there to prevent conflicts of interest and maintain public confidence in the legal system.
And in this case, the fact that SIPC's lawyers had previously worked on a related SEC case against some of the same defendants led to their disqualification.
That's a big deal.
Huge. And finally, never underestimate the importance of procedure.
Know the rules. Follow the rules.
Yes, exactly. SIPC's failure to raise their stock parking theory in a timely manner meant they lost the opportunity to even argue that point.
It's like showing up to a game after it's already over.
Pretty much.
So to recap, SIPC's case was hampered by a lack of standing, issues with proximate cause, an ethical dilemma with their lawyers, and a procedural misstep with their stock parking theory.
It just goes to show how complicated litigation can be, even when you think you have a strong case.
Lots of moving parts.
Tons. And for our listeners who are studying law, this case is a great example of how different areas of the law intersect and can impact the outcome of a case.
Securities law, procedure, ethics, it's all connected.
Exactly.
It really makes you think about how these concepts of standing and proximate cause might play out in other areas of law.
It's something to keep in mind no matter what kind of legal work you're doing.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. It's been a fascinating journey through the complexities of SIPC v. Vigman.
Always a pleasure to break down these intricate cases.
Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp.
And don't forget to check the rules.